I'm sure that all of us have heard the phrase and used the phrase warm and fuzzy. Right? You've heard the phrase warm and fuzzy. You know, the phrase, when I think of warm and fuzzy, I think of, some experience that is warm and fuzzy. Peaceful, tranquil, comforting. It's a place that I want to be. If warm and fuzzy was a place, if there was a hotel called Warm and Fuzzy, I'd want to say to my wife, hey, honey, you want to check into Warm and Fuzzy? Let's go there for 2 weeks. Let's put a do not disturb sign on the door and let's just experience Warm and Fuzzy for 2 weeks. Over the last 10 years, my family, we've had two dogs. Our first dog, and you'll see this on the slide, was Sissy. And we named her Sissy after my niece or something whose nickname was Sissy. And so we tend to name family members, dogs after family members, literally. And this is a weird way we love our family. So we have Sissy on the left. She was a Jack Russell Beagle. There was no affection. There was no warm fuzzy from our dog, Sissy. But CJ, who was also named after a family member, well, he's a standard poodle. And if you know anything about standard poodles, my goodness, he cannot get enough warm and fuzzy. In fact, I went into the bedroom this morning. My wife had slept in a little bit, and I had been working on my message, and there she was, cuddling with the dog. Maybe that's TMI, right? She's going to say, Mark, I can't believe you told that to the whole church. Sorry, honey, because I know you're online coaching with the other team there to help run our church online. But CJ just cannot get enough affection. Well, I'm sure that as we come to this Christmas season, there are many of you that would say, you know, Christmas is a warm and fuzzy season for me. It gives me the warm and fuzzy feel. But others of you would say, no. As a student, think about going back to my home, or some of you are going to gather with your family members, you know, apparently in the area, 10 or no more kind of thing, or we have to shoot you. That's the least thing, that's the last thought you would have. It's not going to be warm and fuzzy. In fact, you might say every Christmas is the opposite. Well, there were a group of individuals 2,000 years ago in the first century. When you would begin to talk to them about the theology of Christmas and all that it means, it would be the last thing that would come to their mind would be this idea of warm and fuzzy. You see, there was a statement that Paul used. It was not a statement, it's a poem. It's believed to be an old hymn, perhaps, that he inserts into a book called 1 Timothy. This past fall, we've been looking at the book of 1 Timothy, Paul writing Timothy. He's living in Ephesus. And in chapter 3, a chapter we never got to, Paul quotes what is apparently a hymn or a poem, creedal statement. And there are some people in the first century living in the city of Ephesus that when they would hear Paul say what he says, when he's in the hall of Tyrannus or in the synagogue, and he spent a number of years in Ephesus proclaiming Christ, when they would hear him say what he says, this hymn, this poem, they would become irate. They would become infuriated, angry, and they would be willing to cause a riot in the city because of this hymn, which speaks of Christmas and so much more. I want us to read this together, 1 Timothy, and it's going to be up on the screen. And let's just read this hymn together. This is what would have irritated so many. Read with me, please. Great indeed, we confess, is the mystery of godliness. He was manifested in the flesh, vindicated by the Spirit, seen by angels, proclaimed among the nations, believed on in the world, and taken up in glory. Now we're going to unpack some of this old hymn over the next few weeks, starting with that first line, manifest in flesh, referring to the physicality of God in a body, manifest in flesh. That line, along with that entire poem, as I said, would have been announced and declared and read repeatedly as a declaration of the mystery of godliness. And there were many people who said, that is not warm and fuzzy. So here's the question that we want to look at this morning as we come to our text, which I haven't given you yet, but I will. The question is, what happened when God came down, manifest in flesh? Why would this be such an irritant? Why would this cause such division, outrage, and as we'll see, a riot? It's an important question because as we answer this in the context of Ephesus, we will see the powerful implications of the incarnation manifest in flesh upon our lives. And it is anything but warm and fuzzy. It is disturbing. It is unsettling. And it is politically incorrect. So, take your Bibles so that I guarantee that I don't teach heresy, that you can check out what I am saying. Acts chapter 19. Probably you've never been told during a Christmas series to turn to Acts chapter 19. You're thinking this is not one of the Christmas narratives. You're absolutely right, it's not. But for us this morning, it is, and I think you'll see why we come here. Acts chapter 19, there's a lot going on here. Paul is in Ephesus. We're not going to look at the whole story. We're going to focus in on one section, which is from 23 to about 31. But before we jump into the text, let me give you some context. Context is king, right? Never read a text without understanding the context, or you'll go a little weird, perhaps. Because then you can make the text say whatever you want it to say. So Paul is writing Timothy, as we've seen over these last several months, Timothy, his young protege, Timothy, this young pastor trying to pastor a very needy church within the city of Ephesus. Ephesus was home to the great temple of Artemis, or Diana. Diana was the Roman name for this goddess, Artemis, the Greek name that is the name that is used in our text. And so I may flip around and call her Artemis, I may call her Diana, just depending on how I feel. There was this incredible temple, and you'll see on this next slide, these are the remains of this temple that was one of the ancient wonders of the world at the time. So Ephesus is the capital of Asia, a Roman province. And there's this complex road system that has been developed that the Romans were known for that contributed to its prosperity and the spread of the gospel. But people would come from all over the world to this temple. You see the pillars that are there. Well, in its heyday, when it was actually all together and standing, there were 100 pillars. It took 220 years to build. It was shining marble. And local legend says that there was that her, Artemis, her statue fell from the sky. And we read that in Acts 19:35, where it says, "Men of Ephesus, who is there who does not know that the city of Ephesus, the Ephesians, is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Ceremonies and services of worship were held in her honor and conducted by eunuch priests." In fact, as you look at archaeology, and this is the wonderful thing about the Bible, right? It's rooted in history because it happened, right? And in the Roman coinage, on this next slide, I think, there we go. Perfect. Thank you, Carrie, for setting that up so beautifully. You can still see the temple, and you can see the Roman coinage with the actual temple on the coinage of the Roman Empire. Now, here's a really interesting fact about this temple. Behind the shrine was a treasury, which was known as the safest bank in Asia, where nations and kings stored their most precious things. And in recent excavations, or in the last 100 years with excavations, they've unearthed various statues. And this next slide, there we go, thank you, even better. Yeah, that's perfect. We can see all three at once. And you can see Artemis, or Diana, whatever you want to call her, and she's a multi-breasted goddess. And the ritual of the temple services were in that day, where it was cultic prostitution and various ceremonies, which was common amongst ancient religions of that day. And so there's the temple, there's the coinage, there's the statue. But here is what really interests us for our topic today. Not only was she worshipped in her temple, but also Artemis was worshipped with these minute, small little shrines that were modeled after the temple. And these little shrines were made from silver at times, or stone, or wood, or clay. And so Ephesus was the major production center of these little shrines. And people would gather from all over the world. They would come to this temple, thousands and thousands of people, to say the least, and they would buy these little shrines, and they would take them back to their homes, and they would set them up so they could worship the goddess, and so that they could build a whole culture around this goddess. And history tells us that when their loved ones died, they would take these shrines and insert them into the cave of the dead person to ensure the presence of their goddess. But the real purpose of these shrines and the selling of these shrines was to increase the temple revenue by their sale at a price which was many times their cost. Jacked up prices, leveraging tourism, kind of like scalping tickets for a hockey game, right? You pay way more than perhaps it's really worth. Well, there were silversmiths who made models of the temple. And do you remember the name of one of those silversmiths? Phyllis? No? You're wrong. Oh, I stumped Phyllis. This is awesome. And it's on video forever. So the name of this, well, the name of this gentleman, he was so ticked off at the Apostle Paul because Paul was threatening the supply chain of these little shrines. His name was, thank you, she corrected herself. You Googled that, didn't you? Yeah, you Googled that. So, there we go. So to read that story, take your Bible and turn to Acts chapter, I've always wanted to do that, Acts chapter 19, verse 23, and this is what we read. About that time there rose up no little disturbance concerning the way, Jesus, for a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades, so the trade unions are together, and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that the gods made with hands are not gods. We'll come back to that line, but don't forget that one. And there is danger not only that the trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing. Almost prophetic, you see, archaeology. And that she may even be deposed from her magnificence. She whom all Asia and the world worship. Notice what Paul says, what Demetrius says, Paul says. Paul says, gods made with hands are not gods. Now, just pause here for a second and think about this. Imagine saying that to someone, not only about their livelihood, but about their security and their object of worship. I mean, think about this. Families, whole cultures, generation after generation after generation have put their hope in Artemis. Thousands of people gather every year to this great temple. They're making huge profits on these little shrines. People insert these shrines into the graves of those that they love to ensure the presence of that goddess with that deceased person. Whole culture, massive income, huge economic engine of Ephesus. And Paul comes in and says, gods made with hands are not gods. Duck. You see that temple? You see that shrine? It's a sham. It is fake. It is bogus. Can you hear Demetrius saying, no, she's not. She is the daughter of Jupiter and the Tonon, the twin sister of Apollo, and Diana was born in the woods near Ephesus. Nothing warm and fuzzy about this at all. This was offensive. This was insulting. This was demeaning and nasty. The Apostle Paul has come into Ephesus with a better story, a better God offer, an upgrade. God manifest in flesh. And he's not afraid to say so. You see, what happened when God came down? Well, the incarnation, manifest in flesh, exposes the inferiority of our gods. Gods made with hands are not gods. God in flesh. Now there is an upgrade. Interesting to read Isaiah 44, and I'm going to read it for you. It's going to be on the screen here. It's a bit of a, there's a number of verses here, but to read about the idolatry, there's so much that matches with Ephesus here. And don't think that, oh, we are a more complex society. Now, we're not guilty of idolatry. We are, and we'll see that, and we all know that. But let me just read this. How foolish are those who manufacture idols? Isaiah says these prized objects are really worthless. The people who worship idols don't know this, so they are all put to shame. Who but a fool would make his own god an idol that cannot help him one bit? All who worship idols will be disgraced along with these craftsmen, mere humans, who claim they make a god. They may all stand together, but they will stand in terror and shame. The blacksmith stands at his forge to make a sharp tool, pounding and shaping it with all of his might. His work makes him hungry and weak. It makes him thirsty and faint. Then the woodcarver measures a block of wood and draws a pattern on it. He works with the chisel and plane and carves it into a human figure. He gives it human beauty and puts it in a little shrine. Does this not sound like Ephesus? He cuts down the cedars. He selects the cypress and the oak. He plants the pine in the forest to be nourished by the rain. Then he uses part of the wood to make a fire with it. He warms himself and bakes his bread. Then, yes, it's true, he takes the rest of it and makes himself a god to worship. He makes an idol and bows down in front of it. He burns part of the tree to roast his meat and keep himself warm. He says, ah, that fire feels good. Then he takes what's left and makes his god a carved idol. He falls down in front of it, worshiping and praying to it. Rescue me, he says, you're my god. Such stupidity and ignorance. Their eyes are closed and they cannot see. Their minds are shut. They cannot think. The person who made the idol never stops to reflect. Why? It's just a block of wood. I burned half of it here for heat and used it to bake my bread and roast my meat. How can the rest of it be a god? Should I bow down to worship a piece of wood? Poor deluded fool. He's on ashes. He trusts something that can't help him at all. Yet he cannot bring himself to ask, is this idol that I'm holding in my hand a lie? Paul pulls into town and he says, I've got a huge, huge upgrade. Gods made with hands are not gods. But well, what does that upgrade look like? Can we improve on our gods? Well, let me just read to you just a couple of the Christmas narratives, just very briefly. Luke chapter 1, where it says this, and you'll recognize these words. In the sixth month of the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city, Galilee, named Nazareth, to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph, the house of David, and the virgin's name was Mary, and he came to her and said, greetings, O favored one, the Lord is with you. But she was greatly troubled at the saying and tried to discern what sort of greeting this might be. And the angel said to her, do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God, and behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. And he will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever and his kingdom, and there will be no end. Bit of an upgrade. And then in John chapter 1, this is the classic, one of the greatest verses in terms of the deity of Christ, God in flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, referring to Jesus. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the light was the light of men. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And then verse 14, and the Word became flesh and dwells among us, and we have seen his glory as the only Son from the Father, full of grace and full of truth. How's that for an upgrade? Or Colossians, Paul says, Jesus is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn of all creation. The incarnation exposes the inferiority of our gods. In fact, the upgrade is seen in the impact of Jesus as we look over the last 2,000 years, undebated. Undebated. Just to read a couple quotes. But there's so much literature on this. No one else holds or has held the place in the heart of the world which Jesus holds. Other gods have been as devoutly worshipped. No other gods. Other gods have been as devoutly worshipped. No other man has been so devoutly loved. As the centuries, and then another quote, as the centuries pass, the evidence is accumulating that measured by his effect on history, Jesus is the most influential life ever lived on this planet. If you don't believe me, check out history. The upgrade is seen not only in what it impacted Jesus, the upgrade is seen in what Jesus actually said about himself. Another quote, another slide. Next slide. Oh, there we go. A Buddha simply said, I'm a teacher in search of the truth. Jesus said, I am the truth. Confucius said, I never claimed to be holy. Jesus said, who convicts me of sin? Muhammad said, unless God throws his cloak of mercy over me, I have no hope. Jesus said, unless you believe in me, you will die in your sin. Paul walks into Ephesus with a huge upgrade. Huge. I mean, think about it. The incarnation, from the very moment it was announced to Mary, Joseph, and all those Christmas characters, the incarnation has never been announced into a godless vacuum. Wherever the incarnation is announced and proclaimed and taught, like this morning, it is always, always announced and proclaimed into a context that is full of gods. And the incarnation exposes the inferiority of all other gods. I mean, think about it. We haven't really changed. As we think of the incarnation, what god or goddess preoccupies our hearts? We're not beyond gods, little g, are we? At all. John Calvin famously said, the heart is a factory of idols. It's a factory that just keeps pumping out idols. One person writes, we have false gods of entertainment, pleasure, fame, money, power, selfishness, instant gratification. You could add to the list. It's endless. C.S. Lewis, in this statement, and I've used this so many times, but it's so, so good. He talks about the inferiority of our gods. In this PowerPoint, he says this, our Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. We are half-hearted creatures fooling about with gods like drink and sex and ambition when infinite joy is offered us, like an ignorant child who wants to go on making mud pies in a slum because he cannot imagine what is meant by the offer of a holiday at the sea. We are far too easily pleased. Paul is offering Demetrius, he's offering Ephesus a holiday at the sea. Gods made with hands are not gods at all. They are mud pies. I'm just paraphrasing what Paul is saying. As I thought of this, I thought, I'm guilty of gods. I'm guilty of false gods in my life. None of us get a pass on this, do we? And so I've come up with a list of questions, and you might like to ask these questions of yourself. This, to me, requires a lot of soul searching. to really identify, because we're so immersed in a God-filled culture of gods. You know, where is my trust placed? Because false gods basically are the places where we put our trust and have ultimate control over our lives. In whom is my hope found? What am I chasing? What or who controls and shapes me? Whose voice is the loudest? What at times does my lack of obedience reveal about what God holds me back? It could be the God of fear, the God that pride becomes a God. Here's an additional question that's not on the slides, but another one that I would add. What or who controls my time? What or who controls my treasures? What or who controls my talents? You get to the base of those answers to those questions, and we might find that Jesus is the one who's in charge. We might find that I'm not sure Jesus is the one in charge. See, this is not warm and fuzzy. Jesus' incarnation exposes the inferiority of our gods. It challenges us to look at where are we placing our trust. So here's a question. If you buy it, what Paul is saying, gods made with hands are not gods, and attaching this hymn, the book of Timothy, with what's happening in Ephesus, then a question we ask, what happens when you realize that what you're holding is so inferior to what you are being offered? What happens if somebody comes along and says to you, you know, what you're holding, the God that you have, is absolutely inferior to the God of the universe who has come in flesh, and he's offering you something that is so much superior? What do you do? Here's where my illustration. This is a little bike that one of my staff members in Jakarta, when we were living in Asia, gave to me as a gift. I've not ridden this bike yet. And now, if one of you wanted to come up to me today and make a trade, I would make the trade. If you offered me a Harley Davidson, a brand new, say worth $30,000 to $40,000, fully loaded Harley Davidson, I would say, idiot, here you go. And I would make that trade any day. Even if I don't ride a motorbike, even though my wife might not let me ride the motorbike, I would sell it, and I would take the money and run. I'd make that trade. But there are some people that wouldn't make that trade, even though it's really obvious. I'm not sure if Demetrius would make that trade. I'm pretty sure there's a whole crowd in Ephesus that wouldn't make that trade. You see, when you read this text described of Demetrius in his speech from verse 23 to 27, which we read, when you read through it, I mean, read through it again sometime. What are the emotions that characterize Demetrius? Does it sound like he wants to make a trade? Does he sound like he wants to upgrade? He's angry. He's upset. He's worked up. He's anxious. He's fearful. There's nothing warm and fuzzy about what's going on here. And then when you read the rest, verse 28, when they heard this, the crowd, they were enraged and were crying out, "Great is Artemis of the Ephesians." So the city was filled with confusion, and they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians, who were Paul's companions in travel. There was outrage. There was anger. They were upset. There was a riot. Not everybody makes that trade. You remember on the Christmas story, I mean, here we have Demetrius, but in the Christmas story, you remember the character Herod? He didn't trade up either. In Matthew chapter 2, and I think it's on the slide there. Now after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem saying, Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Imagine saying that to Herod, who was supposed to be the king. For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship you, Herod. No, to worship him. When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him, and the assembly of chief priests and the scribes and the people. He inquired of where the Christ was to be born. And then at the very end of this scene, verse 12, the Magi, the wise men, have encountered him, and they realize he's duplicit. He's not being genuine. He doesn't really want to worship Jesus. He wants to kill Jesus. And it says, and being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country another way. Remember the question, what happens when God comes down, manifest in flesh? Well, the incarnation exposes the inferiority of our gods, as we see in this story that outrages the crowd. But secondly, the fact of the incarnation invites us to depose of all other rival gods. To depose. So notice in our story, there's a contrast of two groups here. There's the first group, verse 27, and there, Demetrius says, is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worships. There was a whole group of people, as you read the larger context of chapter 19, which we'll look at next week as well, that we're deposing. To depose something or someone is simply to mean to remove from a throne or a high position, to put down, to no longer allow that, whatever it is, to control, to depose. And so there were a whole group of people who heard of what Paul was speaking of, manifest in flesh, God manifest in flesh. And there were a whole group of individuals that were literally doing this. I mean, metaphorically, but in their hearts, it was a decision. They were taking whatever gods they had, and they were taking them from a high position and putting them into a low position. They were taking them from a position of influence and control and focus, something that was shaping them. And they in their hearts, they deposed those gods. And you can read about it as they burn the books earlier in the chapter, $50,000 worth of books, as they come to Jesus. I put it this way, Jesus doesn't join our parade of other gods. He demands total soul allegiance. Jesus is not coming into Ephesus to the proclamation of Paul, and Paul is not saying, you can have all these other gods, and there were many other gods. You can have all of these gods in your parade, and we'll just put Jesus on the back end of the parade, and he'll be one other float, one other god in the parade. No, but Jesus being announced here in Ephesus is announcing, no, I am not going to be one of many floats. I'm a very small parade. I'm a parade all to myself. There is only one float in this parade. And so you have to depose. See, the incarnation exposes the inferiority of our gods, but it invites us to depose, to set aside, to set down from a high place any other gods. And there was a whole group of people in Ephesus that were doing that. And there was a whole group of people, Demetrius and the crowds, that created a riot because they would not. See, Christmas reminds us that there is a better place to put your trust, to put our trust. But there will be a battle at times to depose our false gods. I think we really need to think about this. You see, to truly sing from our heart, oh, come, let us adore him. For he alone is worthy. We'll give you all the glory. Are you kidding me? It sounds nice when you sing it in church. But if I actually asked you, or if you asked me, hey, Mark, how did it go this week? Oh, come, let us adore him. We'll give you all the glory, for he alone is worthy. I would say to you, at times that is a bloody, bloody battle in my soul to do that. Some of us are in that battle right now, the battle of ego, the battle of pride, the battle to trust, the battle to not get seduced by a false god you gave up months ago, and that god is luring you back. A battle because many inside and outside the church follow false gods. That's true. Many inside the church and outside the church follow false gods. Battle of the mind, the battle to resist making other people a false god as we pander to their demands and seek their approval, and the plethora of gods that are available to us, constantly offering us their wares and their benefits. Our culture is an idol-producing culture, and at times our churches, and Bethel is no exception, are idol-producing churches. The incarnation exposes the inferiority of our gods. The fact of the incarnation invites us to depose of all other rival gods. Now let's just imagine here that this bike, as I've said earlier, symbolic. I'm not even sure if the kickstand works, but I got $30,000 for it, so I'm happy. I don't care. Let's just pretend that this represents your god. Little g. Because we all have them, right? Don't say to me, Mark, I don't know what you're talking about. Then lying is your god. As Christians, don't you find that there is a daily need to depose anything or anyone that has control over you? Greater influence than Jesus? You agree? Don't you find that daily there is a battle to acknowledge anything, anyone that wants to have greater authority, greater control, greater influence over me than Jesus? I mean, every day you awake, every day I awake, we need to ask ourselves the question, who is going to be in charge today? And every evening when we tuck ourselves in, who was in charge today? And if you're like me, you might come to the end of your day at times and say, I don't think Jesus is in charge today. Well, he was, but certainly not in my life. How I wrote that letter or spoke to that person or handled my resources and my time and my treasures and my talents, I'm not sure who was in charge, but it sure wasn't Jesus. And if the answer exposes false gods, then what do I need to do on a daily basis? On a daily basis, I need to acknowledge what are those false gods and depose those false gods from having the influence and the control over me. And actually, when I have a false god, that false god often is what disciples me, not the Spirit of God, not the Word of God, not being in Christian community. It's that false god or those false gods that have incredible influence. And as I said, I say it again, this is a bloody, bloody battle. And just in case you think I'm overstating it, just look at the state of the church in some cases. Look at how you behaved this week. Look at how I behaved this week. It's pretty obvious that Jesus does not always have our full attention. It's pretty obvious he's not the only float at times in the parade. Well, as we conclude, there's one more question. He exposes our inferior gods and desires for us to depose those false gods. But why? Let me read two quotes and then we'll pray. The first quote is from Max Lucado. Why does he expose and why does he want us to depose? Max Lucado says this, if our greatest need had been information, God would have sent an educator. If our greatest need had been technology, God would have sent a scientist. If our greatest need had been money, God would have sent us an economist. But since our greatest need was forgiveness, God sent us a savior. And then Dietrich Bonhoeffer states this, who died in World War II because of his faith, because he would not bow to any other gods. The celebration of Advent is possible only to those who are troubled in soul, who know themselves to be poor and imperfect, and who look forward to something greater to come. He is and always will be now with us in our sin, in our suffering, and at our death. We are no longer alone. God is with us, and we are no longer homeless. The incarnation is an invitation to review our hearts, any gods that need exposing, dispose of any false gods that have crept in or back into our hearts. The incarnation is an invitation to put our hope in God manifest in flesh. That's the invitation that Paul was giving to those in Ephesus, to find peace in God manifest in flesh, and to experience the love of God manifest in flesh. So this is what I want us to do as we conclude. I'm going to put this little bike back up here as this illustration. And I want us just, whether you're online here this morning or whether you're with us in this building, I want us just to take a moment of silence and just ask one question. Who is in charge? See, we can say that on a global thing, well, God's in charge, he's sovereign. He's the ruler of the universe. Time past, present, and future. That sounds good. But what about your heart? Let's just take it down to a little speck called you, me. Who's in charge? Who's in charge? Who's influencing? Who's controlling? Who's really discipling you these days? What spirit are you walking in step with? What so-called truth are you walking in? Who's in charge? So can we just take a moment of silence? Who's in charge? And I'm just going to ask that the Spirit of God, if the Lord would bring anything to mind this morning, just in the quietness and in the privacy of your heart, say, God, I choose to depose this false god, to remove from the throne and to put down this false god this morning. So Spirit of God, just in this moment as we're in our homes watching, as we're in this building, just if we could be dead quiet, reflect. Who is in charge? Do I need to depose any false gods?